we'd like in the 30s. We've talked about your academic and professional life. We've talked a little bit about your family, but we've not talked about literature, art, painting, writing in the 30s, and those circles as they impinged upon you.
Yes, well, I didn't really know very many. I was a don, and I lived in Oxford, and I only knew people whom I vaguely met through that. I mean, I wasn't a prominent figure in the literature, not a figure at all in the cultural world, really, then.
But I think you said to me that you'd met the Wolfs at one point.
Yes,
that's what's in my mind.
Yes, yes, that's quite right. Let me begin. The first literary person I met was Stephen Spender, who was my contemporary. He was a year older. He was absolutely charming. He was very good looking and very friendly. And he managed somehow to, and very naive and generous natured. And he went about both with blues and with eyebrows. And that was unusual. The only other person who did that was the present Lady Longford, who was then called Elizabeth Harmon, who should be black, and I'm sure also broke through the barrier. But still, Stephen Spender was at uni. I met him with my first year and his second year. We made great friends. And we used to go for walks together on Hampstead Heath, because he lived there, my parents lived there, and in Oxford up to a point too. Well, the poetry he wrote at that time and for a few years after was really very good. After that, I think, though I oughtn't to say it, it seemed to be in decline. But he's a very good critic, a very candid and penetrating critic to this day. I mean, there's nothing between him and the object. It's unusual. He's not straight categories of any kind, or frameworks, or doctrines.
Anyway. Are you as close to him now as you were?
Yes, he's remained a friend for life. I know him now too, very well. He really is a lifelong friend. Well, he introduced me to Auden. I got on frightfully badly. Auden, I met him in Stephen's house in London, about 1934. He wore a wig.
A wig?
Yes, it appeared to me to be a bald yellow wig. It was eccentric. And I'm not sure he didn't have false beard. That may be an invention, my part. But he looked at me with extreme disdain. And he obviously thought I decided I was a minor bourgeois intellectual of some kind, at best, and treated me with a certain amount of contumely. So I didn't make friends with him. But I met him later.
He was one of those for whom the term bourgeois was at that point a term
of
contempt.
Certainly. He was a kind of homosexual Freudian Marxist. Don't know if he ever read Marx, but that kind of thing. They all were. You see, Stephen also was a man of the left in a very vague and general way. He did join the Communist Party in 1937 or so. I begged him on bended knee not to, and kept on asking why he must. He said, well, he wanted some firm organization to measure his views against. Everything else was vague and soft and no good. Labour Party was, a lot of people felt that. They were dreary bureaucratic, fair, with no fresh ideas and so on. The other part is really impossible.
Urged him not to
why? Not to become, because I thought he wasn't one. And nor is he. Nor has he ever been.
You thought it was untrue to him?
He has no political instruments, so to speak. He hasn't got...
no compass.
His uncle is a famous political journalist called J. A. Spender, famous friend of Asquith, Lloyd George, and so on. So he imagined his father was a German political journalist also, called Harold Spender. So he imagined he was had political ideas as well. He was a man of the left as we all were. But he had no doctrines and he didn't have an analytic mind. He isn't one now. He had general sympathies.
But the judgment that he shouldn't join the party was much more a judgment about him than it was really about the party. It didn't come from a sense that this was kind of incarnation of infamy.
Oh yes, a bit.
A bit.
Can't deny it. I was anti-communist strictly. I mean, I knew communists, and I didn't refuse to know them. I mean, I didn't know any Dons. I knew Christopher Hill, whom I did not know to be a communist. I knew to be left-wing, Marxist. He was the only left-winger communist I ever knew who went into Russia and came out again entirely unaltered. He went there, I should say, about 35, came back probably a year later or so, no difference at all. Said exactly. I had postcards from him from Moscow. Shows they were in very good terms. Above all, one showing a lot of Soviet marshals together. Most of them were purged. Not very long after. Very compromising postcard.
Yeah. But you didn't take him up on this inconvenient...
No, he could be, well, he wouldn't have minded that time. Yeah, I think he believed every word Stalin ever said. Until the 20th Party Congress. Whatever it was, really. He was a true believer.
Yes.
He's now no longer a member of the party, but he's 100% Marxist to this day. Yeah. But he was the only Don I knew, of whom it could be said that he was in fact a communist. Well, except I say I didn't know it at the time. And there was wait a minute. I've told you about the Pink Lunch Club.
Yes.
Now, wait, go on about that.
Yes.
He belonged to that. Anyway, Stephen Spender, yes.
Tell me a little more about why Auden was so disagreeable to you.
Can't, I don't know. It just was rather rude. So I didn't take that very well. No reason was given.
Did you find his homosexuality distasteful?
He wouldn't have known it. Although Stephen was too, and we were great friends. And I knew that about him. And I never... but homosexuality, I can talk to you about separately. It's a topic of some interest. I'm in turn. But who invented by Maurice Barra.
Yeah.
But Auden, well, I've just finished you about Auden. You might sort of. I met him afterwards in New York in 1941 when I was stationed there. Can't remember how. Through a woman called Anne Fremantle, who was a Catholic lady, a Bohemian lady who lived partly Washington, partly New York, who knew him. He was extremely friendly. And we got on beautifully from that moment on. And I went to see him in Brooklyn, where he lived with Gypsy Rose Lee.
Really?
Yes, she was there. I did a with him in the same house. And a man called Jimmy Stern and his wife. He was a minor literary person, translator and so on. And we had dinner. And he was wonderful, extremely warm-hearted and friendly. I thought he was awfully nice. Can't think why. Total change of attitude. Because they were both Englishmen abroad or in exile or whatever it was. So he thought. And then I learned something about him. He played to me records after that. In particular, Nabucco, from the Snow to be an opera by Verdi. Now, in Nabucco, Nebuchadnezzar, whom it's about, if you remember, he suddenly bursts his hubris. He says, I'm king of everything, I'm king of the world, I'm God. At that point, God strikes him. And he's not killed, but he collapses. And he goes out of his mind and starts eating grass, according to the legend. At this point, Winston said, the headmaster, he began talking American English, and the headmaster didn't like that much. I realized then, and forever after, that Auden's view of the world was in terms of public school. He thought of the world in public school, that he liked having images, similes. He thought in terms of some kind of construction, that kind. You see,
how did one
the world of school.
How did one story allow you to make this elaborate judgment?
When he talked about the rest, I realized, when he was talking, he made remarks how I fitted. I realized what he thought was, I checked for Stephen Spender too, but he thought, on the whole, the world was a place where the headmaster, the headmaster. There was God, then there was masters, wanted to obey. Some of them were unjust. Some unfair, some unfair, couldn't tell. Then, all sorts of things happened. You were the rules. The rules had to be obeyed. The rules had no rational basis of any kind, but if you didn't obey them, you were rightly punished. In other words, he believed in a kind of mysterious discipline. Stephen later put it by saying, for him the world was a chessboard. If you were in a white square, you were all right. If by some bad luck you were in a black square, you suffered.
Yeah.
But there was no telling why black was black, white was white.
Yeah.
There was no moral basis for it.
Yeah.
A theological basis, a mysterious kind, maybe, you see. But no moral basis, it was transcendental.
Yeah.
In some transcendental somewhere. Yeah. This is what he thought of the world as, and he thought he was he and the other boys, you see, and no relationship was boys, homosexuality, boys, school, it was all one.
Yeah.
David Sissel once said to me about him and Betjeman and somebody else, I think some other homosexual, not Stephen, some third one, who was it? Isherwood, I think. But they had the sentimentality of the changing room.
Yeah.
Which is very brilliant. Yeah. Exactly right. Yeah. Infantilism, yeah, of a certain kind. Homosexuality, yeah, sentimentality, infantilism. But it was all the jokes of public school jokes. The language was public school language to a large degree. There was a certain arrestedness.
Yeah. And arrestedness, presumably, even in the way he thought about politics, because the schoolmaster metaphor applies to a vision of the political
world.
Yes.
Freud was a very important master. Marx was a very important master. And you could change. Topic you could change. Subjects, of course, you could stop doing mathematics, start doing history. Well, that's allowed. But within a school framework, the world was organized in, no doubt, ultimately intelligible, but to us, non-rational lines. Mm. We couldn't understand, but we had to obey. Mm. And one had to develop certain fixed habits which got one through life. Orton always drank until 6 o'clock in the evening, vodka martinis, then stopped drinking. He went for, the opposite.
Yeah,
never drank before 6.
And then drank.
At 6, drank steadily. Mm. By 8, he was drunk. That was so in New York, it was so in Oxford afterwards, I noticed. But we became great friends. He even dedicated a poem to me, which I'm very proud of, because I thought he was a poet of genius. Mm. So do. We had one or two, mal entendu, one kind of misunderstanding.
Can you tell me? Oh, yes, certainly.
Let me try and think. Yes. He wrote a review in the New Yorker of his autobiography of Maurice Barra, whom he had a certain, he was part of his world. I mean, he didn't like him really, Maurice Barra like him, but still he was part of the Oxford he knew. And that was designed to some degree of immortality. Anybody at Oxford in his day was okay, in some way. They belonged to a proper context. And Maurice Barra reported in this letter that he had been in America after he failed to become professor of Greek. It was a great disaster for him in Oxford. Because Gilbert Murray didn't like him, but he didn't say that. And an excellent man was Orton's greatest friend in England called E.R. Dodds, who was made professor of Greek. It was a very just choice. Even Orton worshipped him.
A brilliant scholar.
And father, yes. And a father figure to him in Agnes, in Birmingham. They both were at one time. Anyhow, Maurice Barra reported that he wanted to take a letter saying he's going to take a job in America. And we all dutifully wrote saying, don't stay in America. Come back to us. Which we obviously intended to do. And he did come back. He became warden of Odom and all as well. And Orton said, I don't know why, as I bet we should have said that. I mean, he was a, why shouldn't he have stayed in America? What's wrong with taking a job in America? And then he said, Berlin was a great success in America. It was a notorious success in America. God knows why, roughly. He didn't say God knows why. And therefore, this piece of advice to Maurice Barra seems quite very inconsistent and absurd.
You then had a correspondence on the subject?
Not quite. But I think I complained in some way. I think I've written a postcard, maybe, saying that they couldn't quite understand why.
And the subject was neuralgic with him, obviously, because he...
Because of exile, yes. Yeah. Because of being in America. And because Maurice Barra didn't stay and behaved like a English patriot all through the war, you see. And did not join the Comintern in any true sense. Although he was homosexual, he wasn't regarded as one of them by them. He would have made a perfectly good father and husband, in fact. He was pitched into it by failure with women, by a number of factors. He wasn't on the natures. Homosexuals, which is Orton was.
Yes.
Well then, I think that's the only contra, because he's a bit contemptuous about this connection. Well, why should he, you see, I mean, saying, oh, very well, he seemed to do very well in America. What's wrong with him? Yes.
But not contemptuous of you in other connections?
No, not at all. Oh, no. Not to my knowledge.
Your friendship continued through the war?
To the end. Yeah. And then he came to Oxford, you see. He came to England and he became professor of poetry. And I saw him frequently then. He was very good. There were some good lectures, both on poetry and on libretti, which would have been interesting. He sent me all the libretti of his operas, which I wrote two long letters about, which I'm sure he destroyed, about the Bassarids, which was about the Becky, and the Magic Flute, which he did for television in New York with, what's his name, with his friend, who was already designed 41.
Yes.
What's his name? Chester. Chester Calvin. Yes. Was a little Brooklyn Jewish boy. Mm. And Auden took an unnatural interest in Yiddish, Jewish stories, everything which came from Brooklyn.
Why unnatural?
Because
of Chester.
Why should Auden be interested in Yiddish-speaking Jews as such? And he used to read a book called, by some Jewish author, called The Rabbi Wrote Late on, The Rabbi Rose Late on Friday. It's kind of Father Brown stories translated into Jewish context, so Rabbi was a detective. He read them avidly. He used to talk to him about it.
Did you ever kind of twit him?
It was
about
very,
it?
Very.
Did you ever tease him about that kind of?
Of course, yes.
Sort of all on Judophilia.
Didn't like Jews that much, wasn't it? But he was somehow obsessed by whatever he happened to be in the middle of. It just became a kind of object of interest. Yeah. One never knew what he would pitch into. Mm. And that's why, you see. And then he came to Oxford and I saw him with his press of poetry. He held court in the Cadena Cafe, as it's, I think it's still called that, to undergraduates on probably Friday morning or something.
This was in the 50s?
This would have been the 50s. Then he came back in, I suppose, the late 60s, early 70s. Rather, like Ian Forster, he wanted to settle Christchurch. And did. They weren't quite sure they wanted to have him, but still a great poet. They could not. And then he was a great bore to them, because he was drunk at dinner. I used to come to dinner with him occasionally. And he would tell the same story over and over again. I used to go to dinner with other people. If he noticed me, he would address me, you see. And he talked endlessly, you see. And I can tell you quite a lot about him in Oxford, but that's not very relevant. But I had to go to his opera written with Nicholas Nabokov, which was called Triple L, Love's Labour's Lost, referred to as Triple L, Dumb, Brussels, I think. And you know, all that's just a little gossip. Go back
to the 30s.
All right. Then, in the 30s, I met Steve Spender, certainly. I met Virginia Woolf. I met her. I never became a friend of hers, but she's one of the people I really had hero worship for, and still have. Mm-hmm. I mean, by nature, hero worshiper. I'm giving you a list of my heroes. Mm-hmm. I thought about that the other day. Somebody asked me. I said this to somebody. Who were they? I gave a list, so I remember it.
Well, let's have it while we're...
Okay, while we're fresh. My heroes were, before the war, Toscanini.
Toscanini.
My hero worshiper. I thought, his whole attitude, I mean, of course the conducting came first. I thought it was the most marvelous performances of anything I ever heard. Schnabel, not quite so much a pianist, but near. Because his performance of Beethoven transformed him. He had a new conception of the series of the music. Schubert and Beethoven, wonderful. Stephen and I used to go to these performances endlessly. Toscanini, absolutely extraordinary. I've never been. And also, he was extremely passionate, proud, and handsome, wouldn't go to Nazi Germany, all that rather pleased me. You see? Every story I heard about him, when he was in Salzburg in 1937, which of course produced more money for Salzburg than anything ever had done, because all the Americans came, they hadn't done for. And Schuschnigg, who was then Prime Minister of Austria, wanted to be on good terms with the Germans, tried to persuade him to have Furtwängler, who was then playing in Germany, and he refused flatly, 36. And the Zaman said, you know, he's not really a Nazi. He plays along with his weak man. He's a German, he sort of conforms. But he doesn't believe these things. And Toscanini said, exactly as I believed, not even a Nazi. Something I liked.
Other heroes.
What? Other heroes. In the end, he did come. Then, my next hero, in order, Virginia Woolf was, than Edmund Wilson was. Weizmann was. Wait. I've now forgotten the name of the Weizmann was. What political name it is. Roosevelt was. Very well said. Stravinsky was.
Do you ever meet Stravinsky?
I knew quite well. We'll come get to that, yes.
Tell me about Virginia Woolf.
Well, she, her mother, no, her father was the brother of the mother of Mr. H. L. Fisher, who had been a historian, as you know, and he was a, Lloyd George made him a member of his cabinet, as Minister of Education, and then he came back to the Wharton and New College. And he was her first cousin there. And he invited her to stay a weekend. His wife, Mrs. Fisher. Said, I never liked Virginia Woolf. Very priggish, pretty woman. I never liked her. Ah, but it's cousin of hers, I suppose. We can't help having her. But... Well, the people of us, I knew Fisher's daughter very well, still do, called Mary Fisher, who's now called Mary Bennett, who became head of St. Hilda's College in the end. And she consulted me about who should be asked. And we made a list, which is all right, at least my list is all right. We asked John Sparrow, I think, who certainly admired greatly. David says I wasn't at Oxford, so he couldn't be asked. Not then, he was a friend of hers. Mary herself, a friend of hers called Rachel Walker, might have known it. C.S. Lewis, because he was the English lecturer, fellow of origin, English lecturer in New College. So this was asked automatically. A man called Carr, who was a classics don at Brazen's, because he was a polite young man who filled a trap. Crossman, Mrs. Fisher liked, extravagantly. Though he didn't. Now, who else were we? I think that's probably all we were. And she came. I thought she was the most beautiful person I'd ever seen in my life.
No, yes. Incredibly beautiful.
Were very beautiful, very light blue eyes, and a kind of unfocused gypsy look. Very thin. She was rather like an idealized version of English governesses. She was like a sort of, idealized at the end of this, somehow outside the series, towards which we attended. But she was wonderful. And she had a beautiful voice. And she talked in similes.
Why beautiful?
Well, it was silvery, it was high, it was steamy, it was, I don't know, it was even. And it was difficult to say about a voice, because it was gentle and firm and rather musical.
And precise.
Very precise. Very firm. She didn't waffle. Well,
there we were. She spoke in sentences. Her diction was clear.
Complete sentences. And similes and analogies and images, which were almost as good as our books. All I remember is, at one end, at my end of the table, Fisher would say, Virginia, do you ever eat Scott? She said, no, I think it's all terrible nonsense. Fisher was a bit, David Sessler has written quite interesting lecture. Ah, David, yes, well, he's got a very wide taste. Then silence, and he said, do you go for walks to the country? She said, yes, I do. Quite often in Sussex. What do you most like? I like goats on the sides of hills. They look so ecclesiastical. That's all. At the other end, Mrs. Fisher would say, I like Uppingham. It's a hearty school. Crossman was shouting. C.S. Lewis was shouting. They couldn't bear. She was the opposite of what they wanted to meet.
Yes.
They were hearty, coarse, tough.
Yes.
You see? Lewis hated women anyway. You see, Crossman was, hated intellectuals, prissiness, eyebrows of every kind, nosers, frightful.
In that division
spices.
On the table, you were clearly on her side.
Well, obviously. And then I talked, I suppose, a little. Then we all went upstairs, afterwards, about 50 undergraduates. She was like a bishop, very nervously, about to confirm. Didn't know what to say, she stood. And said, has anyone here read Jane Eyre? Someone put up his hand. Oh, oh, I'm so glad. Can you tell me the plot? She went on like this, very nervous. She really was embarrassed. Till Mrs. Fisher said, well, 10 o'clock, I'm going to bed, and I advise everybody else to do the same. Stay back, stay here if you like. Then she tramped off, and everybody went away, and I was left with her and him and 5 or 6 other people, and then she relaxed completely and chatted very amiably.
Leonard was there.
What?
He was there. Leonard was there.
Who?
When you said you were left with Virginia and her husband.
No. He refused to come. It was one good reason. He thought that Fisher was the man who invented the black and tans in Ireland. That Lloyd George would say to him, Fisher, you're a historian. We have a mutiny in our hands. What does one do? Well, I can imagine. Probably imagine that Fisher said, well, take a lot of men, put them in mufti, put them on khaki or whatever it is, put them on trucks, put them on lorries, and so on. Anyhow, he was convinced that Fisher was in favor of the black and tans. Such a man could not be spoken to. He refused to come. That's that day. Then later, she wrote 2 letters, one of which is misdated in Nigel Nicholson's edition. Both about me. I mean, about me, about lots of things, but mentioned. Not at all favorably. She says about me, yes and no. She says about me, one is written to Quentin, who's the nephew, and one is written to her sister. And she says, opposite me I had, not quite the notorious, the famous or something, somebody surprised me in 1934. I said, Isaiah Berlin, obviously I'd been talked to her by somebody. A Portuguese Jew, by the looks of him, by Portuguese. I believe a communist. There's no bearing on anything. I think my looks must have suggested that vaguely.
Yeah.
Wait, how did it go on?
The second letter.
No, it went on. Something like Too Clever by Half, something like that. Something mildly contemptuous.
Yeah.
The next letter said, again, clever, I think, but reminds me of the young Keynes, which is older, young Maynard, which is rather better. And went on slightly in the style, but it was ironical,
yes.
Not friendly.
Whereas you were much more, you seem to have been much more smitten.
I was overcome. I met her again, you see, with, without knowing it was written about me, which I met again with Lady Tweedsmill, who was the widow of the by then dead
Governor
John Buccaneers,
yeah.
Who had been brought up with Virginia in some London square. And just crazy for a moment. And was Lady Tweedsmill, who was brought up playing one of the London squares with, what was her name, the Grosvenor, some sort. And then I just chatted away. And we talked about Stephen Spender. And I said, have you met his friend? With whom he was living. He was called Penny Heinemann. He went to Spain when she had to rescue. And she said, in a silvery voice, Klaus. I said, yes. Oh, well, yes, I don't think. I'm very anxious to meet him. This snobbery was total.
Yeah.
Total. The whole of Bloomsbury.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Mm. She then said, Stephen is such an enthusiast. He talked about a book called In the Province, written by, what's his name? Prince Charles's mentor.
Lawrence?
Yes. Lawrence van der Post.
Lawrence van der Post.
Which they published,
yes.
The Hogarth Press. It's quite a decent book. But the way they carry on, I simply can't understand it. I mean, it's quite good, not bad. We did publish it, she said. She talked about literature quite. That I don't think is recorded in the letters, that meeting. Then she more or less fell in love with, or at least took up with, a lady called, whom I mentioned to you last time, called Sally Graves. Sally Chilver, who then said to me, she wished me to come to dinner, which I did quite late, in 1938, it was all right. It was in Golden Square where they lived. Leonard was there. The first time I met him, he was very, very nice to me, very charming. And very typical gay conversation was, first of all, she always liked to guy somebody, to make somebody a butt. On this occasion, it was Ben Nicholson, who was a friend of her, great lover and so on, as you know, but who was then an assistant keeper of the King's Pictures. And she said, Ben, when you go to see the King, do you bow very low, do it on your knees, not that went on. Just she said to her, once to Hugh Walpole's friend, Hugh, is your car lined with gold? That sort of thing. And Ben tried to answer. No. Then I remember, she said, you know, Royal Day are quite interesting. I remember when I was with Duncan Grant, and Princess Beatrice or somebody came to visit the studio. And Leonard was fumbling with the gas fire, and with a trembling hand, couldn't find the match. I said, I don't see why you should say that. Royal Day are exactly like anybody else. They're perfectly ordinary people. There's no difference at all. You're quite wrong. They're very, very different, and they're simply wonderful. She then said to me, you came in carrying a book with you to put in your overcoat pocket. What was that? I said, it's a book about Henry James. A book about
Swinburne.
The man who wrote the Red Letter.
Crane?
No. That's an Edge Courage. No. 1840s.
American Hawthorne.
A book by Henry James.
Yes.
About Hawthorne, there isn't a book. Oh, she said, Henry James. I imagine you read him a great deal, do you? I said, certain about. Yes, well, I expect no bats in your belfry, she said.
What did she mean by that?
That I was a very rational, clear-headed, nothing funny. She said, plenty in Henry James, you know. Well, of course, I didn't know. By the time I met him, he was nothing but a frozen-up old monster. Yes, all that I could report to. And it went on like this. It was a very happy evening. Yeah. She talked a great deal.
Yeah.
She talked about...
This is 38?
Yes, about. I met her only once again in the same year when Ben Nicholson had a kind of vernissage, some sort of his new flat in Bloomsbury. They all turned up. She sat on the floor, a long silk dress spread elegantly in many directions. We all sat round her in worshipful attitudes. And then again, I can't remember what she said, but the image is wonderful. She described how her dress caught fire. It was very well done.
Really? In what circumstances?
In some house somewhere. She didn't notice suddenly. Again, describing the flames. She really was a terrific player. She was very eloquent. But she was nervous. She'd met about 5 people in her life. And if she met other people, she barked like a nervous dog.
Really? She could take 5 at a time, is that what you're saying? No,
she didn't want to meet strangers. She was nervous. She knew 4, 5, 6 people intimately. Met very few other people. Bloomsbury entirely. When fresh people presented, she was nervous. She didn't know what to say. She, as I say, barked nervously. Could be rather rude. Didn't really want to make friends with anybody much. Lived confined to her own circle. She was, of course, virulently anti-Semitic. But that came out of the diaries. And that was censored by Leonard. In theory, every word is printed, because Bloomsbury believed in no concealment. He did tell me, by the time I came to know after her death, that the passage was such appalling, Nazi-like, and racism. That he thought, well, of course she was rather crazy. One time to went away. And then he looked after her with utter devotion. He was wonderful, saintly to her.
And your worship for her was worship of the
books.
Person, but also
both,
books?
Both. I didn't like them all equally. But I have 3 or 4 books of wonderful.
Which ones, the ones that you
No, well, I thought Mrs. Dalloway was wonderful. I thought The Lighthouse was wonderful. I did not think The Waves was wonderful. I thought Night and Day, which people thought was a potboiler, was wonderful. The years, fairly good. I thought the Common Reader was wonderful. Yes, he did. I thought Jacob's Room all right, or fair. The feminist texts, not terribly interesting. What was I read by her? I didn't terribly like it, but everybody adored. It was Between the Acts, which was the posthumous always, quite late. Mrs. Manresa. Now what else did I read? Or could I have read? Yes, I thought the first one was very, very good. The very first one of all.
Yes.
What is it called? Written during the First World War. Before Jacob's Room, I think.
I thought it was Dalloway.
What?
I thought it was Dalloway.
No, Dalloway is written in the 20s. Mm. I'll tell you what I didn't. Again, I'm being critical. The pages in each book were absolutely marvelous. For example, I didn't tell you, like, one about Vita Cycle West.
Yes.
That was, what is it called?
Yes, I know.
Elizabethan one.
Orlando.
Orlando.
Yes, sir. But there's some one
embarrassing, I think. Marvelous. Description of the, freezing of the Thames.
Yes.
And people only were too wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes, she was just, yes.
I thought she was one authentic writer of genius in that little group.
Mm.
Not much better than Forster, much better than Litton Strachey, much better than anyone. Leonard I got to know after the war. He's very amiable to me, and I dedicated this little book on Vico and Herder to him, because he made it publish. It was necessary to see sort of encouragement and letters and so on. Very nice man. And one thing which I never understood about him, in 1937, quite late, they took a holiday in Germany. Well, Leonard Wolf was a very identified Jew. I mean, he had nothing religion or other Jews, but he used to talk about it, and his autobiography goes on about his mother going to synagogues and all that. How could they go to Hitler's Germany then for a holiday? More than that, he asked Harold Nicholson for a letter of introduction. Harold said he couldn't do it, but if he went to America with the Wigroom in the Foreign Office, he might fix it up. Well, he went to see Wigroom, was rather anti-German in fact. Wigroom introduced him to Prince Bismarck, who was chancellor in the German embassy. And Bismarck wrote a letter saying, Mr. and Mrs. Lindwolf are very eminent literary persons, I thought they treated every great thing so on. There's a description of a Nazi march in the autobiography. Then I couldn't understand. I asked Quentin Bell, professed not to be able to understand either. They were so arrogant that maybe he thought Nazi regime was not that much worse than any other. All regimes are horrible, they're all ghastly. He was a very devoted socialist, as you know, a Labour Party man. Well, and then that Thursday in my own name. Then she asked me to dinner, which again, but his letter arrived in when I was in Washington. But it arrived after she did. I mean, it's not somehow eerie. His letter was saying, do come and knock on a little grey door in Gordon Square on such and such. But I think it came fairly late in 41. It's forwarded to me with a lot of other mail to the embassy, to New York, I think.
By which time you knew she was dead?
By which time I knew she was dead. So that I could have died if I had been in England. So obviously in some sense we got on.